A minute goes by, and still the damn thing is afloat. You turn your gaze out to the water. You notice now that the raft is surrounded by many sound-looking canoes, each carrying a family of indigenous fishers. Men on the raft are systematically forcing people out of the canoes and onto the raft at gunpoint, and shooting holes in the bottoms of the canoes. This is clearly insane behavior. The canoes are the only possible source of escape or rescue if the raft goes down. And taking more people on board the already overcrowded raft is gradually bringing its deck even with the waterline. You reckon that there must now be 400 souls aboard. At this rate, the raft is sure to capsize in a matter of seconds. A few seconds elapse. You can see and feel water lapping at your shoes. But amazingly enough, the raft itself is still afloat, and nearly everyone is still busy eating, drinking, or gambling. Indeed, the activity around the casino has heated up considerably. You hear someone in the distance shouting about how the raft is about to sink. You rush in the direction of the other voice, only to see its source being tossed unceremoniously overboard. You decide to keep quiet, but think silently to yourself, "Geez, this thing can't last more than another couple of minutes. What the hell should I do?" You notice a group of about a dozen or so people working to patch and reinforce one corner of the raft. This, at least, is constructive behavior, so you join in. But it's not long before you realize that the only materials available to do the patching with are ones cannibalized from elsewhere on the raft. Even though the people you're working with clearly have the best of intentions and are making some noticeable improvements in the few square feet on which they've worked, there is simply no way they can render the entire vessel sustainable, given its size, the amount of time required, and the limited availability of basic materials. You think to yourself that there must be some better solution, but can't quite focus on one. As you stand there fretting, a couple of minutes pass. You realize that every one of your predictions about the fate of the raft has been disconfirmed. You feel useless and silly. You're about to make the only rational deduction, that there must be some mystical power keeping the raft afloat, and that you might as well make the most of the situation and have some barbecue, when a thought comes to you. The sustainability crowd has the right idea, except that, as they rebuild their corner of the raft, they should make it easily detachable, so that when the boat as a whole sinks, they can simply disengage from it and paddle away toward shore. But then what about the hundreds of people who won't be able to fit onto the smaller reconditioned raftlet? You notice now that there is a group of rafters grappling with the soldiers who've been shooting holes in the canoes. Maybe, if some of the canoes and their indigenous occupants survive, then the scope of the impending tragedy can be reduced. But direct confrontation with the soldiers appears to be a dangerous business, since many of the protesters are being shot or thrown into the water. You continue working with the sustainability group, since they seem to have the best understanding of the problem and the best chances of survival. At the same time, your sympathies are with the protesters and the fisher families. You hope and pray that this is all somehow a nightmare from which it will soon awaken, or that there is some means of escape for everyone that you haven't seen yet.
That's an allegory for modern life as I see it. I think industrial civilization is kind of like a Titanic. It's this magnificent thing we've built over the last 200 years, but it's nearing an iceberg. And in the analogy, the fisher people are basically the indigenous peoples of the world who still maintain some kind of sustainable and survivable traditional way of life. And rather than learning from them, we're shooting holes in their canoes, metaphorically, and forcing them to become part of our civilization, which is nearing the iceberg.
And you say, we're in deep trouble, and it is essential that we understand the nature of the trouble we're in. Once we have done so, we must examine our options. What's the nature of the trouble we're in, and what are our options?
Well, in the book, I speak about several what I call colliding storms, making up sort of a perfect storm situation. And among those are the coming an imminent, actually, peak in global oil production, the continuing increase in human numbers, population growth, which is increasing the stress on ecosystems, and then, of course, our way of life is causing our fossil fueled way of life is causing global warming and the disappearance of untold numbers of species and so on. And then there's the factor of increasing economic instability in the world, caused in no small part by unsustainable levels of debt in the U.S. That's likely to lead to a kind of economic implosion over the next few years. And the reason that's important is that if we're going to deal with these other crises, we're going to need to make huge investments in conservation alternative energies, transforming our food production system so that it's not reliant on fossil fuels, and so on. That's going to take a tremendous amount of investment and effort. And if we're in the middle of an economic crisis, when we're trying to do all of that, it's just going to be that much more difficult. And the final one, of course, is diminishing per capita food production, which relates also to population growth and some of the other problems as well. But all of these are rebounding off of each other and creating a set of problems that is probably the most profound that our species has ever faced.
Now, the issue of diminishing hydrocarbon resources, is that any longer controversial? How long do you think the people that run the society, that run the governments, that run the industries have been aware of the situation, even though it's not something they tell to the average citizen?
Good question. It's impossible to know. Short answer. Longer answer is certainly the folks in charge have some idea of this. We know, for example, that Dick Cheney is the former CEO of the world's foremost oil services company, Halliburton, and he gave a speech in 1999 before he left that post at the Petroleum Institute in London, in which he basically outlined the challenges facing the international oil industry over the next 10 years. And he painted a pretty grim picture, so I think it's fair to assume that he understood back then that we would be facing a crisis in oil supply around the middle of the first decade of the new century. Others, the CIA certainly keeps very close track of global oil production. But also, at the same time, we have an almost a theology among economists that says that resource shortages are almost impossible by definition. It's the result of a mindset that basically says the market can solve any conceivable problem. And the influence of economists on political figures, on policymakers, is so strong that I think it's at the same time also true that many people in power are completely deluded about the nature of our situation and have very, very tenuous, shallow grasp on the nature of these problems that I just outlined.
Given the obviously long calculated plan to invade Iraq and other countries in the Middle East and establish bases, do you think that they're deluded about the problem, or do you think that they are, if you will, a subjective thing, deluded about the solution to the problem?
Well, frankly, it's a bit of A and lots of B. I think they're deluded to a large extent about the nature of the problem, because most of them, even if they're aware that fossil fuels will be becoming more scarce and expensive, have a shallow understanding of the real context of that problem. In essence, what we're talking about is the universal ecological dilemma of population pressure, resource depletion, and habitat destruction that's afflicted every human society, and in fact every species since the dawn of time. And there are only a small range of solutions to that dilemma. Some of them are supply-side solutions. We've become ingenious at pursuing those as a species, but there are also demand-side solutions. And politicians, by their very nature, tend to prefer supply-side solutions because demand-side solutions require that they tell their populations the unpleasant news that they're going to have to scale back, conserve, change their way of life. Politicians don't want to do that. So I think the folks in charge are deluded to a certain extent about the nature of the problem, and that causes them to narrow their view of potential responses to include primarily only supply-side solutions. So if the problem is that fossil fuels are dwindling, well, we just have to compete for what's left or find some other resource. But unfortunately, other resources don't appear to be all that abundant or convenient or economical. So that leads us back to Plan A, just essentially, as we're doing in Iraq, finding where the resources are, building bases, protecting our access to them, and preparing for what's likely to be a global free-for-all in the coming years. The competition is pretty fierce now, especially between consuming countries like the U.S. and China. But after the global oil production peak in a couple of years or so, that competition is going to become much more fierce.
In your book, you quoted, I believe it was former CIA Chief Woolsey, saying that the invasion of Iraq was the first sally of World War IV.
That's right. And I think that, not just Woolsey, but also people like Cheney and Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and so on, genuinely believe that that's the case. In their book, this global conflict for the remaining petroleum supplies is inevitable at this point. So the question is, can we win it, and what do we have to do in order to do so? So the scary thing is that I don't think anyone can win this kind of conflict, because what we're looking at is not just a matter of invading and occupying one country, which is hard enough as we're seeing, but also competition with every other oil-consuming country. We're looking at the likelihood of increasing political instability within oil-producing countries as different factions battle over control of the wealth that those resources are going to produce as they become more scarce and expensive. This is a battle no one can win, and that's why I passionately advocate a plan B, a different approach, which I call power down, which is cooperating and conserving and basically changing our way of life, cooperating on a global level to transform our industrial society so that it is more localized, smaller scale, slower, and sustainable.
It seems, at least to me, that the powers that be have made a choice, perhaps one of the most significant choices in the history of this species,
right,
without consulting anyone else as to what their opinion is about it. Can you explain in detail how power down would work and to what level the cooperation of states and authorities is necessary to accomplish it, or what could be accomplished by people in the absence of support from their government or in contravention of their government as their government pursues a, last one standing, fight to the death scenario?
Yeah, well, that's a huge question. Different versions of the power down scenario have been presented really for the past 30 years or so. It started at least with the book Limits to Growth back in 1972, and a number of people have written about this since then. I'm looking at my bookshelves now, and I just see stacks upon stacks of books Recent ones include Plan B by Lester Brown, who started World Watch Institute, Howard Odom's book, A Prosperous Way Down, on and on and on. Basically, all of these authors are saying essentially the same thing. They're saying we have to get off this this roller coaster of industrial growth and transform our economies so that they're steady state economies that are operating within the biological limits of planet Earth. The idea that you can have perpetual economic growth in a finite system is insanity, and yet it's embedded within our economics. It's embedded within the economic theory that's taught to every new generation of economists and that gets programmed into the operating system of every industrial society. So that has to change. And when, as it does, we will be forced with the necessity of taking this movie of globalization that we've been living in over the past 20 years and running it in reverse, relocalizing our economies. The problem with globalization, well, there are many problems with globalization, but from a purely ecological standpoint, one of the main problems with globalization is that it assumes unending amounts of cheap energy, energy for transportation, so energy for the extraction and transformation of other resources, so that we would be transporting manufactured goods and resources ever further distances. That's why we're buying all of our stuff from China. That's why there are no significant manufacturers of food and, or excuse me, of shoes and clothing left in the United States. All of that stuff we buy from other countries. So we have to reverse that. We have to support our local economies. And the food production is central to all of this because, of course, currently the average food item on our American plate has traveled something like 1,300 to 1,500 miles to get there. We've globalized food production. And exactly the opposite needs to happen. We have to take fossil fuels out of food production and relocalize food production. None of this is easy. None of this is going to be simple or cheap, and it's going to require tremendous sacrifices from the population. It's not likely to be a popular idea. The only reason for even mentioning it is that if we don't do this, our only other real option is going to be global, deadly, chaotic global competition for the remaining petroleum resources, which will run out anyway. Regardless of what we do, regardless of who wins the battles.
What role does the actual financial system, the capitalist system, and the way in markets play in this whole scenario?
Well, capitalism is a kind of ideology that has been built up over the past couple of hundred years, which has been a unique period in human history where we've had more and more energy available year after year. Because of fossil fuels, the extraction of this non-renewable resource. And so embedded into economic theory is the assumption that this expansion and growth in available energy and resources is natural and normal and that it's going to go on forever, which is, as I said earlier, clearly insane. But it's an idea that, of course, is extremely attractive to people because every time we see a problem anywhere in the world, our solution to it is always the same. Well, grow out of it. And growing mean increasing the extraction of resources, increasing production, lengthening the chains of transportation of resources and products, and increasing the human population. Over the short term, a solution like that can work as long as you have an expanding resource base. But the actual fact of the matter is that our resource base is shrinking. We live on a finite planet. And the sooner we get that through our thick skulls, the better off we'll be.
Well, what obstacles exist toward implementing an economy that functions on sustainable principles? I mean, what are the obstacles?
Well, one of the biggest obstacles is our propaganda system, which is otherwise known as the American advertising industry. This is like a $225 billion a year industry whose sole function is to convince every last one of us that our purpose in life is to buy, consume, and use. And each of us is an individual in this process, and what our individual choices affect no one else and have no significant impacts on the planet around us. And all of these are complete lies. We have a propaganda system that is turning us into blithering idiots. What we desperately need, first of all, is a contrary message. I'm not an authoritarian kind of personality, but frankly, I think the best thing that could possibly happen would be if somehow we could just take over the advertising industry and turn that message exactly 180 degrees the other direction. Because what we desperately need is a kind of World War II level of effort where the population would understand the problem and be working together to solve it. And we're not going to have that as long as people are getting the wrong message.
Okay, so we're talking about a scenario where we may already be at the peak of oil production, or that may be something coming within the next few years, a 2 or 5, or different people disagree. I mean, everyone is seeing a precipitous rise of gas at the gas pump, a rise in their heating bills. It's kind of hard to avoid that. How do you imagine that the advertising industry is going to continue to put a happy face on that situation?
Well, what we'll be told is that it's somebody else's fault. I think we'll be given scapegoats and told that there's nothing wrong with the American way of life. We're entitled to it. It's our birthright as Americans, after all, simply because we're God's chosen people. We're the favored people on the planet. So if we're having a problem, if prices are going up, it's because of those nasty people on the other side of the planet who insist on raising prices or sitting on their oil instead of selling it to us cheap. I think we're being set up for that kind of propaganda right now, and we're being set up for what our vice president has called war for the remainder of our lifetime. So rather than explaining to us why the economy is falling apart, why energy prices are shooting through the roof, I think we'll just be manipulated into more resource wars.
And looking down to the end of that, it seems to me that in the resource war scenario, ultimately nobody wins.
That's
everything
right.
Everything is destroyed by violence and blood and depleted uranium and atomic bombs and.
Well, that's why I call it last one standing. I guess the hope of the elites is that even though ecosystems fall, populations fall, nations fall, that there will be somebody left standing, and whoever has the most money and the most guns is who gets to win the contest. But for the rest of us, too bad.
Well, for the rest of us, given that the people in charge of this government are clearly insane, if not evil, and it doesn't seem to me that even if Kerry had gotten in,
right.
I cannot imagine, at least at this point from everything I've seen of the process, that there would be any significant reevaluation of the whole project of the American way of life. And from what you say in your book, that we should have been at it yesterday, so to speak.
Well, yes, 30 years ago.
Yes. I feel that we as people in the know, and hopefully more and more of us will get in the know if those few of us doing independent media can get the word out widely enough, and people like you writing books like Power Down, what are we to do? What can we take in our own hands other than just sit and wait to die? I mean, it's just like, who can stand that? You have to try to do something. What can we do?
Well, one of the chapters in my book it describes an option that I call building lifeboats. And the whole idea may seem a little grim, but it's no more grim than what we've just been talking about. And in fact, I think it offers a ray of hope. Of course, I'm as embedded in this whole situation as everybody else, and I don't like it any more than anyone listening to this. But as a social scientist, somebody who studies human civilizations, I was once a member of an academic organization called the International Society for the Comparative Study of Civilizations. So I've been looking at this question for a long time of why civilizations arise and why they tend to collapse a few centuries later. And looking at it from that kind of dispassionate scientific academic viewpoint, it would appear that we are living in a civilization, the biggest, most magnificent, most fast-paced and opulent civilization in the history of the world. But nevertheless, we're living in a civilization that is probably in the early stages of collapse, and very predictably so for all the reasons we've been talking about, which are analogous to the kinds of reasons that other civilizations have collapsed. If that's the case, what should we do? Well, In a recent, relatively historically recent instance, the collapse of the Roman Empire, we saw that a lot was preserved. A lot of what had been achieved during the course of that civilization was preserved by small communities, relatively small communities, monasteries, that kept alive the arts, the crafts, the sciences, the literature, the arts that had been developed earlier, and continued the development of these, even though the rest of the society was in a state of in some cases chaos or reversion to lower levels of complexity. I think we need to be thinking about that same thing now. Obviously, this is not a strategy that will appeal to everyone. I wouldn't expect that everyone would want to do it, but I don't really aim my message to the vast majority of Americans. I don't think the vast majority of Americans are going to listen until, you know, they're paying $7 a gallon for gasoline. I'm primarily interested in talking to the 1 or 2 or 3% of the people who are able to see the handwriting on the wall, to connect the dots, whatever metaphor you want to use, and begin to make some serious choices in their lives now, so that they can be the carriers of this essential knowledge, culture, history for future generations. I think we need people who are doing seed saving, because seeds are in many ways one of the essences of human culture. We've spent hundreds of generations developing domesticated plants, and right now, because of the consolidation of the seed industry, the development of biotech foods and so on, we're seeing a collapse in the genetic diversity of the human food supply. This is just one example, but if we have these kinds of I don't think of them as survivalist communities, but rather as preservationist communities. If we have these kinds of preservationist service communities that have as their purpose not only conserving, but also of educating and serving the surrounding larger community, then I think they will be protected during the coming times. Because they are providing tangible services to the people around them. I think survivalism as a strategy is a complete dead end, because, you know, if you're growing your nice little vegetable garden patch and your neighbor is starving and has a shotgun, guess who's going to be eating out of your garden? And so if you get a shotgun, your neighbor waits till you're asleep. I mean, there's no solution with that path. But I think if at least a small percentage of the population is going down this route of developing preservationist service communities, there could be a tremendous payoff as a result of that.
Let me ask about time frame. You brought up the Roman Empire, but that really took hundreds of years to kind of finally collapse and disappear.
Right.
And unlike, it seemed like in that time, you know, somebody could kind of run away and get lost somewhere. Now there's no, seems like no corner of this globe that hasn't been, you know, encircled with a border and border guards and a government and a state. And so it's not even, and furthermore, there's the widespread damage to the ecosystem itself, which of course covers the globe. So if there's catastrophic climate change at the same time that these other social upheavals are going on, it seems like we're in a little bit of a different situation than a person at the collapse of the Roman Empire.
That's right. And I think that as industrial civilization has taken root and bloomed and flowered in a relatively short period of time, just a couple of hundred years, I think its collapse is likely to be relatively quick as well. I don't think it's necessarily going to happen in the space of you know, a minute or a day or a month or a year. It could occur over several decades. But nevertheless, we're not probably not talking about 500 years. We're probably talking about a much shorter period of time than that. So, and also, as you say, it's not something one can easily escape. And that's why I'm not one of those who's thinking about moving to, you know, Canada or Belize or someplace like that. Not that somebody who is contemplating it shouldn't, but I think it's important that many of us just stay right where we are, put down roots, and become indigenous humans.
And how do we learn? I mean, this is so alien to... I live in, fortunately, a rural area where there are actually farms and people grow their own food, and there are cows, and, you know, they give milk. This is not, by and large, the experience of most people.
That's right. Yeah, people are going to have to relearn a lot of skills that have been forgotten. Just the loss of farmers has been catastrophic over the past century. Of course, this has been touted as one of the great benefits of industrial agriculture. That, you know, it used to take 60% of the population to grow food for themselves and everybody else, and now it only takes, you know, 1% or 2% of the population to do that, because now we have all these mechanized, all this mechanized farm equipment that does all the work for us. But take away the fossil fuels, and it's a different story. Farming, to do it well, requires a lot of experience, knowledge, skill, and so much of that has disappeared. A tremendous service can be provided by people developing those skills again themselves, and then helping to teach them to others. So I think that's one of the better arguments for these kinds of preservationist communities I've described.
On what scale do you think this is already happening? You go around the country and you speak. You've written these books, and I know that whenever I play this material on the air, there's always a tremendous amount of interest and people saying, "My God, well, I don't want to just sit here. I want to do something." I know that there are organizations forming all over. People are trying to talk. People are trying to figure out how to take off. It's such a big thing. How to bite off a piece that they can chew of this,
yes.
Right? If
yes.
You know what I'm saying.
Right.
And so from your view, going all over the place, communicating with many people, what's going on out there that, you know, we don't see, you know, reported, you know, on television,
well,
you know, under the surface there?
There's exploding interest in all of this that we've been talking about. A year and a half ago, when my book, The Party's Over, came out, there was almost no understanding among the general population about the phenomenon of peak oil and how close it is in time and its likely consequences. Today, that understanding is much more widespread. Just in a few days, November 12th, 13th, and 14th, there's going to be a conference in Yellow Springs, Ohio, on peak oil and primarily on our responses to it. What can we do as local communities? If people want to find out more about that, they can go to www.smallcommunity.org. Community Service is the organization that's putting together this conference. So I'm basically inundated these days with requests for radio interviews and emails and phone calls and so on. And I'm only one of probably a couple of dozen people who are out there right now writing on this subject and seeking to get it out to the general population. So I just see it, you know, in the last few months we've seen the cover story of National Geographic on the end of cheap oil. We've seen articles in virtually every major newspaper in the country. There are documentaries on BBC several documentaries being made here in the U.S. There's one that's already out. It's called The End of Suburbia, and people can find that by doing a Google search. It's excellent. So people can get that documentary, buy a copy of the DVD, and show it in their home to friends and relatives and raise awareness and get the discussion started. You know, what are we going to do in our local community? How are we going to make the transition?
Now, you mentioned that you get all kinds of requests for radio interviews and emails and whatnot. Do you ever get contacted by any government officials interested in trying to address this in any way?
You know, my experience of government officials, and I've had conversations with members of Congress and also local officials, my experience of them is that they are so busy putting out fires that they do not have any time or space in their consciousness to think about the long-term, bigger picture of where we are headed as a species. There are a few exceptions to that. And in fact, I had a wonderful conversation not long ago with a member of the Energy Subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives who said that she's pretty familiar with this idea of peak oil, and she's very, very concerned about it, but she's afraid to say very much publicly because, of course, it's such a dicey political message. You know, nobody wants to be associated with the idea that you know, the American way of life is basically unsustainable and we're going to have to change it, because that brings up memories of Jimmy Carter back in the 1970s, who said essentially the same thing, and of course he got turfed out by Bush won, but with Reagan and Bush, who said it was morning in America, and of course, people love to hear that.
Oh, well, gee, as an ecologist, can you explain, because I guess I don't understand it, why people would rather hear something that's not true? I mean, to me, it doesn't make any sense. So, maybe you could explain what,
I think it's kind of genetically hardwired into us. You know, we have this fight or flight response. If it's an immediate threat, we don't like that, but at least it's something we know how to respond to. We're hardwired to respond to that kind of thing, either by fighting or fleeing. But if it's a kind of threat that is slowly gathering, it's long term, and the response to it is going to take some cooperation and intelligence and some sacrifice, well, that's a lot more complicated. It's more difficult.
What about the technological quick fix? People say, we're going to have this new technology, or we're just going to. I mean, you've actually gone into this in great detail in Power Down as to kind of nixing the quick fix. I mean, much to the disgruntlement of people trying to, you know, take a positive attitude towards what is coming towards us.
Yeah, well, I don't want to be too discouraging to people who are developing alternative energy sources, for example. I think we need that. I have solar panels on my house, and I drive a car that runs on modified vegetable oil. All of these things are great ideas, and we need to be investing, you know, literally hundreds of billions of dollars a year in the development of alternative energy sources. What I dispute is the assumption that this is going to automatically happen and that it's going to be painless. Whenever I bring up the subject of oil depletion, typically, one of the first responses is, well, but won't we just be driving hydrogen cars? People need to understand the steps that are involved, the investments that are required, and the pitfalls along the way in the transition to an alternative energy-based technology. It's not going to be the kind of economy that we have now. It's going to be a very different kind of economy. And the transition is going to be extremely expensive, and it's going to take time. Unless we understand that, then I think there's the tendency of people just to delude themselves and to say, well, there are smart people in the world, and the people in charge wouldn't let bad things happen to us. I'm sure somebody's taking care of this, so why should I bother? Why should I even pay attention?
Let me ask you something. Would all of this be easier to accomplish if we didn't have money?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, if there was no money, so no one would say, oh, it's going to take, the materials are going to cost this much. It's going to cost this much for the labor. If we said, forget it, nothing costs anything. Let's just go get the materials and do the work and make it happen.
The kind of money we have is certainly a huge barrier. Money per se wouldn't necessarily be a barrier from the standpoint that it's money is ideally, if in the best situation, money is a symbol of energy. Energy is what allows things to happen. It's what enables us to perform work, and money does that too. It enables us to obtain resources, goods from one another. It enables us to hire each other's labor and so on. All of this is symbolic of energy. Now, if the transition to alternative energies is going to cost trillions of dollars, that's symbolic of the fact that we are going to have to invest a lot of hard work and a lot of resources in that direction. Now, on the other hand, the kind of money that we use now is a huge barrier because the money that we have now is a fiat-based currency that is created through the process of making loans. When a bank issues a loan, that money is literally created from nothing in the process of making the loan. And when the loan is repaid, the money effectively disappears. Now, what this means is that every dollar that exists, having been loaned into existence, is also tied to interest because interest has to be paid on those loans. So the money supply has to grow continually. That means that the economy has to grow continually if the people who have those, who've taken out those loans, aren't going to default on them because they don't have the money with which to pay the interest. That interest money has to come from somewhere. And ultimately, it comes from somewhere within the entire economic system where other people are taking out new loans to create more money so that there's more money in the system so that everybody can pay back the interest on the loans. It's a little complicated, but essentially, that's the picture. As long as we have an interest-based currency, debt and interest-based currency, we have to have economic growth. Is the only alternative is economic contraction and depression. So what we desperately need is a non-interest-based currency, and I think local currencies are a good alternative to this. There have been a lot of people who've done very good theoretical work on this. Bernard Léotard is one. There have been books written about it. I think this is one of the key roadblocks to arriving at a sustainable culture.
So how could we at the present time work around the monetary system to obtain the resources that we need?
Well, on a local level, establishing local currency is an excellent strategy. Now, it takes hard work, and as long as the dollar is still relatively functional, local currencies are inevitably going to be very marginal. But as we saw in the Great Depression, places that did have local currencies were able to flourish, where other places that relied upon national debt-based fiat currencies were hammered. This was true in the U.S. It was also true in many places in Europe. So if we can get these local currencies going now, before the proverbial...
you know what hits the fan?
Yes.
Well, listen, here in our area, in Ithaca, we do have a local currency.
Yes.
And that makes us feel really good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really nice. But the reality is that it's actually been very limited in its use.
That's right.
Because, a guy who runs a hardware store who sells shovels that are imported from China cannot get more stock from China with Ithaca hours.
That's absolutely true. It just reinforces what I was saying a moment ago. As long as the U.S. dollar is still functional, these local currencies are going to be very marginal. But I think it's important to keep them alive because at some point they could mean the difference between a community absolutely collapsing and being able to survive in some sense. At the same time we're doing that, we need to be strengthening our local economies. Walmarts, for example, are soon going to be a thing of the past because the whole essence of the idea of Walmarts is importing goods from further and further distances and on the basis of cheap energy. That's not going to be a reality for much longer, and the Walmarts of the world are going to be a dim and distant and unpleasant memory, I think. What they're doing is they're cannibalizing local economies. We need to stop that process wherever we can and do just the opposite to strengthen local economies.
How high do you think the price of... Has anyone, as I said, tried to answer the question, how high does the price of oil need to go to kill Walmart?
I don't know anybody who's done that research, figured out those numbers. But I think once we pass the point where oil is $100, $200 a barrel, then we're certainly in completely new economic territory, and I think we'll begin to see a whole different set of economic incentives that favors local production for local consumption and makes globalization not just a bad idea politically, but economically infeasible.
You hear people say things like, I can't afford to be a farmer. And I said, well, that's a bit ridiculous. Isn't that rather the most important? Isn't that activity number one, or certainly
yes,
right up there at the top of survival food?
Absolutely.
What kind of society has people who can't afford to grow food?
Right. We need to find ways of supporting our local farmers, and ways of doing that are shopping at farmers markets and also CSAs, community-supported agriculture, where people contract with the farmer to supply them with seasonally available fruits and vegetables. That way the money goes directly to the farmer, there's less to the middleman, and virtually none goes to long-distance transportation. Those are the kinds of strategies we need to be implementing on ever larger scale.
Say, vis-a-vis probably the most recent experience that we, at least here in America, know about, which is the Great Depression. I mean, how analogous is this to that? Is it similar? Will it be worse? Will it be of an entirely different order?
Well, in many ways, it's going to be worse, I have to say, because the Great Depression was something that was relatively temporary. We were able to grow our way out of it. Of course, World War II helped in that regard. What we're going into is something that where the constraints arising from scarcity of energy resources will not go away. In fact, they'll continually worsen and deepen. So everything will depend on our ability to adapt collectively and cooperatively and rationally to that situation. And to the degree that we can do that, the degree that we can create a no-growth, sustainable economy based on non-interest-based, non-debt-based currency, I think we'll come out on the other side in a very good shape. You know, it's possible to imagine a situation maybe 50, 75, 100 years from now where people could be living in local communities, strong economically and socially, culturally strong local communities where people would have much more time on their hands. They would be engaged in meaningful work. You would know who made your shoes. You would know who grew your food if you didn't do it yourself. There would be a lot more manual labor going on, but there would be full employment because there would be lots of work needing to be done. We can get there. It's not going to be easy, but there's no reason that the process of the collapse of industrial production has to be the end of the world.
But what about the carrying capacity of the planet? And the fact that hydrocarbons have actually caused more people to be able to eat because there's been an unnatural amount of agricultural production, if you want to put it that way. What about that?
Yeah, this is one of the most challenging aspects of this whole discussion. We humans have done what any species would do when presented with a sudden and profound subsidy of food and energy. We've grown our population to take advantage of that. There were fewer than a billion of us at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and there are 6.4 billion of us now. We've added 400 million just since 1998 or 1999, when we passed the 6 billion mark, which in that 400 million is roughly equivalent to the population of North America. So we've added North America's population in 5 years, but of course we haven't added a North America's worth of resources and support infrastructure. So this is a huge problem. And with declining per capita food production, there's the problem that we may not be able to support this growing population, and we may in fact be facing very large-scale famines over the next few decades. It's going to take a tremendous amount of cooperation and creativity to avoid that, and I can't imagine a scenario in which that takes place that doesn't include strenuous efforts to systematically, gradually reduce the human population through control of birth rates. I'm not talking about deliberately killing off large numbers of people. Certainly not that. We have to find humane ways and hopefully even democratic ways. It's possible even to imagine market-driven ways in which people are given, basically certificates that enable them to have one or two children, and those certificates are tradable and sellable. You know, there are all kinds of scenarios that people have thought up for how to do this. None of them is likely to be politically popular. But the alternative, I'm afraid, is pretty horrific.
It struck me in thinking about all this after reading your book that, what the people are thinking, the Dick Cheneys of the world and so on, is they're thinking, we're not worried about all those other people because we're just going to nuke them, and then we'll just take the oil, and we'll be fine, and we'll have the American way of life, and they'll all be dead, so we won't have to worry about sharing those resources. And what is astonishing to me is that there are people that have the nerve to refer to this as moral leadership. And then furthermore, there are the lunatics that think that all of this, as the planet is, storms are destroying things and the earth is poisoned and people are dying of famines and bombs are going off and nukes are falling. They're going to say, this is great. Jesus is going to come get me now. And I feel like for those of us that have had this information, are really concerned and say, fine, we want to put our shoulders to the wheel and do something. It's not only that we have the global and ecological problems, we have problems with members of our own species that we have to fight.
That's right. Well, I couldn't have said it better myself. It does paint a pretty grim picture, I have to say.
Well, listen, how can we all, what do you suggest? How can we all keep in touch with one another, you know, all over this nation and all over this world to try to put our, you know, our heads together, our resources together? Because it seems to me that the people that want to begin doing some serious work in this regard need all the help that we can get.
That's right. Well, we have to form alliances where we can. And we have to remember that we are living in a kind of bubble here in this country in particular. If you're lucky enough to travel elsewhere in the world, to travel to Europe, Asia, South America, Africa, particularly Europe, I think you'll find that the vast majority of people on this planet have a much more realistic understanding of our predicament and potential solutions or options, at least, than we do in this country. So those of us who do have this awareness, it feels like we're alone, but in fact we aren't. In fact, we are in the majority on the planet, and we need to reach out and form alliances wherever and however we can with folks in other countries, so that the potential for cooperation is maximized. And the potential for this last one standing scenario that's being acted out by our current administration is hemmed in as much as possible.
How can people get in touch with you, learn more about your writings and your work, or even if they want to come take classes from you at New College in the San Francisco Bay Area?
Yeah. Well, of course, they can find out about New College at newcollege.edu. And they can reach me at my website, which is www.musemuseletter.com. And also another good resource is Post Carbon Institute, which has the movie The End of Suburbia for sale on DVD, as well as my books and books by a number of colleagues of mine.
And that's postcarbon.org.
That's right.
Richard Heinberg, author of Power Down, Options and Actions for a Post-Carbon World. Listeners, particularly those in the Finger Lakes, though all are welcome, may be interested in a listserv we've established for people wanting to get informed, inform others, and take concrete action toward building sustainable infrastructure. You can sign up to the listserv by sending a message to FOIL, F-O-I-L, at lists.riseup.net, FOIL, at lists.riseup.net. Many local groups in the area are having conversations and making plans. Please feel free to use the listserv and this program as a way to get the word out about your post-carbon-related organizing. And you can contact this program at unwelcome@radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, ALL.net. Thanks to Janet Coleman, Dave Adelson, and Greg Cottrell for their contributions to tonight's program. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will all